I call this meeting of the Property Tax Division to order pursuant to Rule 10.01. I first order of business is I would like to represent welcome Representative Coley Hurd to our committee. She is taking the place of the empty spot we had when Representative Greenman had to leave our committee. So welcome, Representative Hurd. The first order of business is that we're going to need to take the roll to determine who's present. The clerk, Mr. Peterson, will now take the roll.
Chair Joachim?
Present.
Vice Chair Gomez? Representative Hertas?
Hertas here.
Representative Anderson?
Anderson present.
Representative Becker Finn? Representative Fisher?
Fisher present.
Representative Green?
Green here.
Representative Hassan?
Hassan's here.
Representative Herr?
Herr present.
Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt present.
Representative Mortensen?
Present.
Representative Pulowski?
Pulowski present.
Representative Torkelson?
Torkelson present.
Vice Chair Gomez? And Representative Becker Finn? All right. That concludes the roll. The quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I want to take note that all the committee documents for today have been sent to members and are on the committee page on the House website. Next item on the agenda is the approval of minutes from February 3rd. Representative Fisher, have you had the chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Chair Akeem, I have reviewed the minutes from our February 3rd meeting, and I'd like to move their approval.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Does anyone have any questions about the minutes? I don't see any blue hands, so seeing no questions, we'll move to a vote. Representative Fisher moves the minutes for February 3rd. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The motion is adopted, and the motion is approved, and the minutes are adopted. Okay, folks, we'll settle in here, I promise. Next item on the agenda is Ms. Schill. She's going to go over the Property Tax Division Jurisdiction Tracking Spreadsheet. And I do appreciate the format she's put it in for all of us to understand it a little bit better. So, Ms. Schill, will you please proceed?
Okay, Madam Chair, I've shared my screen. Can you see it?
Yes, we can.
Perfect. Okay, and as long as I can scroll it, life will be good. For the record, my name is Catherine Schill, fiscal staff, nonpartisan, and I'm going to do a quick review of the spreadsheet. What you see before you is a condensed version of this tracking sheet that's been posted since January 13th when we did the CARES Act review. At the top, the heading, this tracking sheet, like tracking sheets in all finance committees and taxes, reference the most recent state budget forecast, which is done twice per year in November and February, with updates commonly done at the end of session. This particular sheet shows references to the special session 7, which was last December, and we had some updates to our tracking at that time. It also shows that this is for tax aids and credits and appropriations by fund. This shows that it is a base level spreadsheet, and I'll get into that in a minute. And all numbers are in thousands. Moving to the table heading, that first blue arrow on the left, right here. Note, positive numbers are program expenditures or revenue losses. Negative numbers are cost savings or revenue gains. This type of presentation is the same as tracking fiscal notes, but remember we also use in this committee revenue estimates. This spreadsheet presentation shows a cost impact, which is the opposite of tracking revenue changes. So my job is to make sure that we have the costs reflected as accurate on this spreadsheet. Regardless of the tool that we use to track changes. The columns reflect forecast projections of state resources and spending for a 6-year period. So right here, I've condensed fiscal 2021, which is our current biennium. You'll see two fiscal years of spending, 22-23, and this is the biennial column. And then once again, I've condensed the planning years, fiscal 24 and 25. So for easy reference, the biennial numbers are in the shaded columns. In Minnesota, we budget on a biennial basis and appropriate by fiscal year, and that's important. Also included here are change columns that compare dollar amount changes between bienniums. So this one compares 2021 and 22 differences. This column does the same, compares 24 and 25 to fiscals 22 and 23. So you can see changes in dollar amounts. Okay, let's move to expenditures by fund, the second blue arrow here. This two-page spreadsheet is mostly general fund, but we do have a few non-general funds at the very ends, lines 99 through 111. Currently, the tracking sheet includes 47 budget activities that are administered in whole or in part by the Department of Revenue. Almost all the budget activities here have a statutory appropriation in statute rather than in session law, and also either, number one, a standing appropriation, which is the authority to spend a predetermined dollar amount, and a good example of this is LGA or other aids, or it can be number two, an open appropriation, the authority to spend a forecasted amount to meet a program's objective. A good example of this is anything under refunds, homeowners property tax credit. This is important because this authority to spend state resources is ongoing and independent from the passage of an appropriations bill each biennium. So when there is no tax bill, these base level appropriations will continue. Okay, so let's move on down the sheet, and I've highlighted in yellow for you six different categories of expenditure, including refunds, local aids, property tax credits, and then moving on to page two, you see taconite aids and credits, local pension aids, and other aids and one-time appropriations. Line 95, the third blue arrow, is the total general fund spending for forecasted spending for each of the biennia. So if you go to fiscal 22 and 23, we have just under $4.2 billion of spending in property tax aids and credits. For the planning years, it increases to about $4.3 billion. And a few years back, line 96 reflects changes in senior deferral. That's a program where we receive reimbursements and we issue loans, and we can talk about that if you want more detail. But the tracking is in a place other than this overall aids and credits part. So I add it back in here on line 96 and then get a total for all programs in line 97. Okay, and these are the lines 99 through 111 are the other funds, including the State Conservation Fund, the net loan activity, that's the senior deferral, and then most recently, the federal funds, the coronavirus relief fund that we talked about a month ago. I am going to move down a little bit more if I can see it to get to the table. Oh, there we go, okay. Here's the table. And what I did here is I took that $4.2 billion of spending for fiscals 22 and 23 and put them in table chart according to the categories that I just did. And as you can tell from here, refunds and local aids are the big drivers of that overall. And I think it's 86% of overall spending in 22 and 23. And it's 1.8 $8 billion for each refunds and local aid. So as long as I can go back up to the sheet here real quick, you can see those numbers here and here. And the bigger programs are, this is the Homestead Credit State Refund right here in line one. Our VOS report presentation that Mr. Green will do momentarily will give you more detail on that. But the annual spending is for $22,612.6 million. Moving down to the local aids, the major driver here is local government aid at just under $565 million. County program aid is on line 14 at $264 million. And we can go on, but those are the major components of the spreadsheet, at least the dollar amounts. And if Madam Chair, there are questions on individual items, I can certainly answer that. But that will at least give you a better sense on how to read the spreadsheet.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Members, I want to note that Representative Gomez has joined us. And members, do folks have any questions on the spreadsheets? Give it a minute here. And I know if you aren't thinking of any questions right now, Michelle would be more than happy to connect with you later to answer any questions as well. So members, not seeing any questions, we're going to move on. Thank you, Michelle, that was very helpful. Next we have Mr. Green from the Department of Revenue to present the 2021 VOS report. The VOS report analyzes how Minnesota homeowners' property values and property taxes vary by region and income. We'll take any questions at the end of this presentation. So, Mr. Green, could you please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nick Green. I'm the Property Tax Research Director at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The Tax Research Group at Revenue has a number of main responsibilities, including preparing revenue estimates for legislative tax proposals, projecting future tax and expenditures for the state budget forecast, and then completing tax studies and research reports, and one of those being the Homestead Property Tax Burden Report, which I'll be providing an overview of this afternoon. So I'm gonna go ahead and share my screen here, the presentation. Okay. All right. So today I'll be explaining how the homestead property tax burden is measured, provide some regional comparisons of homestead values and tax burdens from the latest report. I'll talk about the role of the property tax refund and its impacts on tax burdens, and review both historical and future trends that as they relate to homestead tax property tax burdens. So first, a little history of the report. The 2008 legislature passed a session law for the department to prepare and maintain data that compares household income with home market values and property tax burdens. We now have 11 years of data and reports, with the most recent being released just last month for payable year 2019. The report is commonly referred to as the VOS report, after former Representative Gordon Voss, who originally sponsored legislation in 1987, first mandating the collection of this type of data. The VOS report consolidates data for estimated market values, state paid refunds, net property tax, and homestead income, to allow for basic comparisons of Minnesota homeowner income and property taxation by region and income level. There are, though, some numerous factors that affect property taxes, and these factors make true comparisons of property taxes among regions difficult. And I'll touch on some of these factors as we go throughout the presentation. So let's walk through how the homestead property tax burden is measured for the report. The VOS report matches individual homeowner property taxes with their income to determine how big a claim on homeowner income property taxes are. The database includes approximately 1.3 million homesteads statewide. As you can see from the graphic, the 2019 property tax burden is a measure of the property tax as a percentage of income. The property tax is the amount of tax after any credits and refunds are applied. And the income of homesteaders includes both taxable and non-taxable income, which includes things like Social Security income, pension income, and workers' compensation, among others. The Voss report also measures the tax burden before PTR is applied to analyze the impact of refunds on moderating tax burdens. And I'll provide some before and after PTR comparisons later in the presentation. So I mentioned earlier that there are a number of factors that impact the amount of property taxes paid. For a parcel, the property tax is primarily based on the total amount of local levies and its share of the local tax base. In other words, property taxes are determined by spreading the combined levies from the county, the city, township, school district, and special taxing districts across all taxable property in the jurisdiction. And there are a number of factors that affect the levies and tax base. One is the level of the public services provided. The level and cost of local spending varies. Townships generally provide fewer services than cities. School district voter referenda levies are not uniform, and community preferences for public goods and services vary. So all of these are variations that make communities across the state unique and affect the amount of property taxes levied. Another is intergovernmental aid and other revenues. Communities' dependency on property tax varies based on the amount of state and federal aid received and also the amount of non-property tax revenues available. For aids, this includes those under the purview of this division, like LGA to cities and county program aid, and also aid in other areas like transportation, human services, and education. For other non-property tax revenues, some examples include fees, charges for services, and special assessments, and these all influence how much is ultimately raised through the property tax. Tax-based composition in the property tax classification system. So the amount of non-homestead property in a community will impact the extent to which taxes are paid by homeowners rather than owners of other property types. Some communities have significant business property, others are agricultural based, while others are mainly residential. In the property tax system overview by House Research a few weeks ago, they covered how the classification system in Minnesota establishes the relative share of market value subject to tax and how this varies among different property types and ultimately who pays the tax. And then property tax refunds, credits, and exclusions can reduce tax liability if homesteaders qualify for various programs. And some of the upcoming data tables will demonstrate the ability of the PTR to moderate homestead tax burdens. All right, so let's take a look at some of the data from the latest report based off 2019. This first chart shows the distribution of homesteads by market value range. The bars represent the number of homesteads in each $50,000 value range. The darker blue shading you'll see there on the bottom is the number of greater Minnesota homesteads in each range, while the lighter teal colored bars represent the number of homesteads in the Seven County metro area. For 2019, the statewide median homestead value was about $217,000, which you can see would land within the group of the highest bars there in the $150,000 to $250,000 ranges. Now, the darker blue bars representing greater Minnesota are concentrated more towards the $50,000 to $250,000 ranges, and the median homestead value for greater Minnesota was about $165,000. This compares to the median homestead value in the metro region, which was about $259,000, or about 57% more than the greater Minnesota median homestead value. The Voss report uses 20 regions to analyze and compare data variables, 10 in the metro and 10 in the greater Minnesota. So there is additional level of detail in the full report, and you'll hear me kind of reference the full report for more detail as we go on here too. So this next chart shows the distribution of homesteads by net property tax range. And similar to the last chart, the bars represent the number of homesteads in each $500 tax range. You'll notice a similar pattern to the distribution of the median homestead market value chart. And this makes sense considering the property tax is an ad valorem tax and the tax is based off of the value of the home. For 2019, the statewide median homestead median net property tax was just over $2,200. And this is the amount after any credits or property tax refunds are applied. Again, the darker blue bars representing Minnesota indicate a median net property tax that is lower than the statewide median, closer to $1,600 for greater Minnesota. And for the metro, the median net tax is around $2,800. You'll notice the top range there, labeled more than 4,500, has the most homestead counts. And more than 80% of these are homesteads that are in the metro region. And this is kind of a function of the metro region generally having higher homestead values compared to greater Minnesota. One example, kind of east southwest Hennepin County region, the median net tax is almost $4,200. So a relatively high percentage of the homesteads in this region would be included in this top tax range of the chart. So I mentioned earlier that the VOSS report uses 20 regions for analysis and comparison. The maps on this page show the 20 regions across the state and the median property tax burden for each region. And so as a reminder, the burden is measured as a property tax as a percent of income. The map on the left shows all 20 regions statewide, while the map on the right zooms in on the metro regions to give a closer view of these areas that show up smaller on the statewide map. For 2019, the statewide median property tax burden was 2.5% of income. So the brownish orange colored shading in the lighter is lighter in regions that have a lower property tax burden and darker in the regions with a higher burden. The maps here help show that burdens vary across regions, with the median tax burdens ranging from 1.7% in the Southwest region to around 3.2% in Minneapolis. So if you remember back to the list of property tax determinants, where we discussed level of services, tax-based composition, and revenue mix, all these impact relative homestead burdens. And so because of the complexity with all of these factors, the report doesn't try to identify reasons for variations between regions, only to measure the calculated tax burdens. And additional detailed data on the data distributions by regions and by income ranges are also available in the full report. All right, let's now take a look at the property tax refund and the role it plays in moderating tax burdens. This table compares the median tax burden, both before and after the PTR for greater Minnesota, the metro, and statewide. For greater Minnesota, the burden before PTR we can see was 2.5%. And after applying the property tax refund, the median burden is reduced to 2.2% of income, which is an 11% reduction. Likewise, for the metro, we can see the burden before PTR is 3.3%. And after applying the PTR, the median burden is reduced to 2.8%, which is a 20% reduction. And so, and Ms. Schill mentioned, the property tax refund now totals over $500 million and projected to grow over $600 million in the coming years, which makes it a significant source of direct tax relief for homesteads across the state. So let's look at a similar table, kind of a before and after PTR now, but this time by income range. So as a percent of income, this table shows that burdens are higher for lower income homesteads. And this is to be expected since the property tax is a tax on value and not a tax on income. The PTR program, which is income-based, has a much stronger moderating effect on lower income homesteads burdens. We can see in the $10,000 to $30,000 income range, the median burden before PTR is 7.5%. And after applying the PTR, the burden is reduced to 3.5%, which is more than a 50% reduction in the burden. At higher income ranges, the impact of the PTR is less since the program phases out as income increases. So targeting those homeowners that are least able to pay makes the PTR quite effective in making the property tax less regressive. The property tax refund is especially effective at reducing the incidence of high homeowner tax burdens. So the two maps on this page show the percentage of homesteads with a property tax burden above 5% of income. With the map on the left showing the percentage above 5% before PTR, and the map on the right shows the percentage of homesteads above 5% of income after PTR is applied. So statewide, Just over 20% of homesteads had a property tax burden above 5% of income before PTR. And then after the PTR is applied, that percentage drops to 8.8% of homesteads with a burden above 5% of income. So, and there are tables near the end of the VAS report, the full VAS report, that provide more detail on the counts and share of homesteads by income range and kind of the moderating effect of the PTR on the homestead property tax burdens. So the last thing I'll cover then is a look kind of at trends over time for homestead tax burdens. Up to this point, we've been looking at the latest information for 2019, so it's helpful to get some historical context. This chart is a time series, look at how median homestead tax burdens have changed over the last decade plus. So the darkest line in the middle represents the statewide median, with the lighter blue line on the bottom representing greater Minnesota, and then the green line on the top for the metro. So if we start back at 2007, we can see that the median burden dropped during and after the Great Recession. You'll remember the housing values were on the decline during this period, which shifted property taxes onto other types of property. In the years coming out of the Great Recession, income growth also was relatively strong compared to property tax growth. So property taxes were consuming a smaller share of income that led to lower median homestead tax burdens. After 2015, we can see the median homestead tax burdens increasing, mainly due to home prices recovering and increasing in value faster than income growth, combined with higher growth in property tax levies that were seen during the years following the recession, homestead property tax burdens increased the last half of the decade. So, and now in 2019, we can see that the most recent data, that property taxes still consume less homeowner income than they did over 10 years ago in 2007. And we can also see that the difference between the median burden in the metro and greater Minnesota has shrunk over the last decade. In 2007, the difference between the metro and greater Minnesota burdens was about 27%. And now in 2019, it's now 19%. And so looking beyond 19, there are a few trends that could impact homestead property tax burdens in the future. One, stronger home value growth has continued since 2019, with lower inventories of homes for sale, pushing up median sales prices. And with strong price growth, the value growth tends to shift additional property taxes onto homesteads and away from other property types with slower value growth than homes. Agricultural values. After double-digit growth in land values during the first half of the last decade, followed by annual decreases then in the second half, agricultural property values seem to be stabilizing. So the property taxes shifting onto homesteads may be easing in some parts of the state in recent years. And then obviously the impact of the pandemic and recovery will likely have varying impacts on homestead tax burdens going forward. Like other things, there are many unknowns. Home sales remain strong, inventories are low, and construction of single family homes are still rising. Commercial property, with the transition of working from home for so many people now, what will happen to the demand for commercial office space and the market value of these properties? I read an article recently about the slowdown in non-residential building projects and construction kind of during the pandemic. So those would be your offices, your stores, hotels, clinics, which in the short term is less property tax base to spread taxes against. So all these tend to suggest upward pressure on homestead property taxes that may shift tax from other types of property. But on the other hand, proposed local property tax levy growth for payable 21 looks like it will be the lowest growth in 7 years since 2014. So the increase in property taxes will be lower on all property. On the income side of things, the financial impact on homesteads, on households has varied after the economic contraction last spring that caused reductions in unemployment and production. There are signs of improvement, but the recovery may take months or even years for some industries. So there's definitely a lot to consider and monitor going forward. So, and this is just a screenshot of the webpage where every year of the VOS reports can be found on the Department of Revenue website. The easiest way to access them by searching the phrase property tax burden. As I noted, the reports include additional detail and explanation, which are very helpful in gaining a better understanding of homestead property tax burdens in Minnesota. So the main takeaways are that regions and communities are all unique and vary in their makeup and preferences and decisions. So there's no one factor that explains differences in homestead property tax burdens, but the VOS report does allow us for, to make some basic comparisons of income and property taxation, and also demonstrates the importance of the property tax refund in reducing property tax burdens for homeowners. So thank you very much for your time and attention. If there's any comments or questions, I can either briefly respond to them now, or I can follow up in an email response for anything that might be a little more in depth.
Thank you so much, Mr. Green. I think that helps us frame things for when we have our discussion around property tax refund and renter's credits that we'll have in a few weeks. I want to note that Representative Becker Finn is here. Members, are there any questions for Mr. Green? Representative Hurtaz, you have your hand up. Go ahead, Representative Hurtaz. I think you're on mute.
I think we're unmuted now. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Green, it seems like the VOS report kind of cuts off the data and compresses or compiles everybody as a 5% threshold in terms of percents of people that are have a burden greater than 5% of income. But you must have the data available to give us some insight as to how many people are paying 10%, 15%, even 20% of their income to pay in property taxes. I get quite a bit of emails from constituents in my district, in Western Hennepin County, where the property taxes seem to be among the highest in past VOS reports, certainly indicated that. I didn't see any graphics of Hennepin County uniquely or segregated areas within the metro area, which is kind of all one big region. So it appears that some of the data, you know, it's expressed as you did, and it's accurate, I'm sure, but it seems like a big region or a big area seems to dilute the result. And, you know, we continue to get a lot of concerns about growing numbers of seniors on fixed income and the values in the metro area because of housing demand keep pushing land prices up. And we have quite a bit of areas in the whole collar of the entire metro Twin Cities, not just on the west side where I reside, but there's a lot of pressure on the land prices, and a lot of the regional planning has mandated that there be 5 or 10 acres of land under each house. So this is a real problem that really isn't going away, and I don't think we're adequately addressing it with the data that's been presented today.
Mr. Green, any comments?
Madam Chair and Representative Hurtaz, in the report, you're correct. We do have, we can aggregate the data at different levels. For the report, some of it's just simplicity of keeping, you know, if we showed 87 counties in the report, that would get a little unmanageable just paper-wise, but this information is available. We do have to be cognizant of disclosure issues. You know, we are working with private income data. And so we do can't drill down too far and have to be aware of that, but that is definitely something we can provide more detail on to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Green.
Representative Hurtaz, did you have a follow-up?
Not at this time, thank you.
Thank you. Members, any further questions from Mr. Green? Seeing none. Next, we are going to go to Ms. Hagler, who is going to give an overview of trade-offs in local sales tax, general law, and look at the recent history of changes around the law. So, Ms. Hagler, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Oh, and I'm muted. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, can you see my screen?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Alex Siegler with House Research, and I'm going to be doing a walkthrough for a few minutes about local option sales taxes. So just a quick overview of what we're going to go over. First, I'll give a brief overview of the policies surrounding local sales taxes, as well as briefly going over how the law has changed over time and into what it is now. Next, I'll talk about the statutorily required features of these taxes and note how these features tie back into those policy aspects and decisions that the legislature has recently made. And then last, I'll talk about some considerations for the committee as these bills get heard this year. So over time, there have been competing policy considerations that have driven how the legislature regards these local sales taxes. On one hand, there's equity, which involves ensuring that localities can provide comparable services at comparable costs to their taxpayers. And then on the other hand, there's the notion of local government autonomy and an allowance for their taxpayers to decide what services to provide and how they should be paid for. And these considerations have driven statutory changes over time. So why does the legislature allow these local sales taxes? There's the consideration that regional projects need a regional funding source, and also local sales taxes serve as an alternative to raising the state sales tax rate, just to turn around and give those proceeds out to local governments through other funding sources like LGA, CPA, or other grant spending programs. So sometimes these local option sales taxes are seen a bit more palatable. So the need for special legislation dates back to 1971, when the legislature placed a prohibition on local sales taxes as part of LGA law. This is just a little snip of the statute, which still exists today, which is why these localities need to come to the legislature for a special law approval. And when you look at the bill's language, usually the first few words are notwithstanding this statute right here. And so what it's doing is saying that these localities can't impose their own taxes or, you know, increase the state sales tax for some reason. So in 1997, there was a recodification that standardized some of the drafting, and within the next 2 years, in 98 and 99, the legislature added the requirement of a local referendum and that a resolution be passed by the governing body of the local government. And then in 2011, the local referendum was made to be held before the locality could come to the legislature for its special law. Most recently, in the 2019 tax bill, the legislature added more requirements to give more control back to the legislature and back to the voters. And in that year, the legislature heard a record number of bills after a record number of local referenda passed. So part of what happened in the 2019 compromise, you'll see the features that come on the next few slides, as to what happened there, and all of the local sales taxes that were presented at that time were included in some form in the 2019 tax bill, and so from 2019 on, these new features are to be imposed. So features that increase legislative control of these, of the 2019 requirements, first, the referendum requirement was switched back from what it did in 2011 so that the localities need to come to the legislature for approval before doing the referendum and going to the voters, which allows for more legislative vetting of the projects and how they're funded. It requires that the localities submit their past resolutions to the House and Senate tax chairs by January 31 of the year in which they're seeking to impose the tax. And these resolutions have to enumerate all of the projects to be funded by the tax and limits the localities to 5 total projects. And then there's also the requirement that the locality submit documentation as to how the proposed project is regionally significant. Some features that increase voter information and control. The 2019 law requires that each project be listed as a separate question at the referendum, along with the amount to be raised for each one. This way, voters can vote on each project separately. Similarly, the law restricts the locality's ability to spend money to spread awareness of the project and the referendum only if each project and its cost is listed separately on the resolution. And if one or more project is voted down by the voters, the maximum amount of money a locality can raise is reduced by the amount attributable to that project. So for example, if a city wanted to impose had five projects on the ballot, but only 2 of them passed, then they could go ahead with those 2 and the 3 would just kind of go away. So this graph shows the number of special laws that have passed in recent years that either enact or extend an existing local sales tax over the years. And as you can see, the number has grown pretty significantly over the past few years, with the number more than doubling from 2014 to 2019. But just to note that there were a few years in between there where there was no tax bill in 2015, 2016, and 2018. So a lot of that could have been attributable to some buildup there. So some things for you all to consider this session. There were no special laws passed last session during regular session or any of the special sessions. And so this year there were 18 cities and 2 counties that submitted local resolutions by that January 31 deadline. And some of them are attributable to carryovers from the last year when none were enacted. And then there's also the consideration as to what constitutes a regionally significant project. And the resolutions that were submitted have shown varying degrees of regional significance. And since there is no statutory definition, it's up to the committee and the chair to make that determination. But as these bills come before you, keep in mind that generally the project should be something with a clear regional benefit beyond just the jurisdiction's geographical limitations. So just a few, this slide just shows some resources for additional information. First is a memo that describes step-by-step how to go about imposing one of these taxes. So if you're curious as to how the process starts all the way through the end, this memo just outlines each step. And if there's a jurisdiction out there that's thinking about doing so for next session or later down the line, I would encourage members to take a look at that. And the second is a longer publication that goes into depth on all types of local sales taxes, not just these general ones. And the hyperlinks should be active in the PDF for the materials, but you can also find them on the House Research website under sales taxes. And that, Madam Chair, concludes the overview, and I can answer any questions if there's time.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. That history was very helpful for our consideration of the bills that are going to come before us very soon. I think we'll save questions for a little bit yet. Members, I also included in the materials the local sales tax memo that I distributed a few weeks ago. And in that memo, I wanted you to start thinking about some input on how we should think about terms like regional benefit and if there are projects that generally do or do not meet that threshold. And we'd like to have a little bit of that discussion here in a few minutes. But first, I've asked some of the city groups to testify today on the general law and give their any reaction they may have to the memo on the local sales tax. Before we move to that, I also wanted to say that I am going to be asking cities when they present also to talk about their levy burden that they have and maybe the last 5 years of their levies, just so we have that in context when we're looking at their material. when they present to us, but we have officials here from three different city groups sharing their thoughts with the committee on this process, and we're going to wait until all three of them have spoken before we move to questions. First up is going to be Mr. Carlson. Mr. Carlson, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you. And again, thanks for giving me the opportunity to work or to share some thoughts about the local sales taxes. Let me say one thing at the outset that I do not, as an organization representative, get involved in lobbying individual sales tax bills, but I have a lot of legislators and city officials that ask me a lot about the process, and so I feel like over the years I have developed some knowledge of how the process works. So if I could share those thoughts with you today, some of these are my own thoughts and some are my thoughts as a lobbyist, but again, I don't lobby for specific local sales tax bills. Let me say, and Ms. Hagler did a wonderful job of outlining the sales tax, and you know, it has become an important tool for many local governments. And I think there's a couple of reasons that you should be aware of as you think through this whole process of defining regional significance and so forth. It's in part because the property tax has clearly over the years become a larger share of local budgets. And that's in part due to the fact that just this last year, we finally got to the LGA funding level of 2002 again. So LGA has diminished, property taxes have increased, and frankly, city officials, when they talk to me, you know, they're looking at projects, local projects, trying to figure out the most efficient and effective way to finance those projects, especially if there is a spillover benefit that extends beyond the boundaries of that community. And a spillover benefit is somebody that's coming in to use the facility, like a library or a civic center or maybe even an ice arena, as the kind of traditional types of projects that have been considered regionally significant. Also, city officials are looking at projects, I should say, quite frankly, that with more approvals of local sales taxes, more cities are looking at the sales tax as a possible funding source and looking at it very critically. And I think Ms. Hagler was right that some of the increase we've seen in recent years was due to the fact that we did not have tax bills enacted. But I think there just generally is a greater share of cities now that are looking at this as a possible funding source because of the aforementioned property tax increases. So even before we added the formal significance test in law in 2019, there frankly was already a regional significance test unwritten, but it was always discussed in the tax committees as legislators evaluated the proposals. I remember one of the first ones that I worked on or I was privy to back in, I think it was even in the late 80s or early 90s, it was for the city of Willmar where they were asking for a sales tax for a library. And they came in with wonderful information that I think it was in excess of 40 or 50% of their library usage in Willmar was from the greater Kandiyohi County area. And they could track that because they had addresses for people with library cards. So they clearly demonstrated that they were providing a service to a much broader area. And so that was a good example of how they demonstrated their regional significance. But that was done without any formal test in law, but legislators understood and gravitated toward that. You know, I should say one other factor I think has contributed to the interest in local sales taxes, and this is not to not to impugn my county brethren, but back in, I think, 2008, the legislature granted counties the ability to impose up to a half-cent sales tax for transportation-related projects. And their imposition of that tax does not even require a referendum or, frankly, legislative approval. They can do that basically with a county board, and I think that, or county board action. And I think that that also generated some additional interest in things like infrastructure and other uses that might be deemed to be regionally significant. You know, this year, I think Ms. Hagler already indicated that there are 20 proposals that have been offered. If I could just share a couple of observations about regional significance. You know, I mentioned the Willmar Library example as a good example. I think that that is something that you're going to have to struggle with if you want to try to define regional significance more precisely. you know, the challenge, frankly, is that what may be regionally significant in one area of the state may not be a regionally significant facility in another. I already mentioned the Willmar Library. You might have a library in a metro city that is largely just a local library used by citizens within a smaller geographic area. And so those two same projects might not necessarily meet the regional significance test. So, and maybe the flip side of that is you might have a park in a metro area city or suburb that is used heavily by people that don't live there, but that in fact frequent the city because of its facility. So those are really very challenging issues to define. If I just quickly move to the equity issue, your memo highlights that, and there, that very truly is something to consider. We have communities with very little retail sales tax base and others with very, very strong retail sales tax base. So there is an equity issue that needs to be explored. But I will suggest as well, though, that retail sales and retail establishments, in fact, don't have any population, but do generate some demand for public services, additional police officers or police calls and so forth. So equity is an issue, but you should also consider that there are countervailing issues along with that, that cities that have a lot of retail sales tax base may in fact have higher burdens that they have to fund in terms of public safety, traffic, and so forth. And then finally, Madam Chair, I know I've gone long here, but I would like to comment on your safe harbor projects portion of that memo, because that is closely mirroring a bill that in fact you introduced on my behalf or the league's behalf last biennium to try to define some projects that might generally be considered regionally significant and that could maybe avoid going through the entire process of evaluation by the legislature. And, you know, I encourage you to think about that. That may be a way to define projects, allow those projects to be funded with a sales tax, and maybe not have to give those projects as much scrutiny or maybe even any scrutiny if you decide to make those purely acceptable under state statute. And then if I could just mention three brief things that have come up this year with the local sales tax proposals. One is I had a city ask about the election requirement. It talks about a general election requirement. And the question arises as to, is a general election any November election or the city's general election? So if a city holds elections in an even year, getting approval in 2021 would mean that they could not hold the election or the referendum until a year from this November. So that's one thing we might want to clarify in law. Number two, the January 31st deadline, this has just come up in the last day or so, is a city that submitted a proposal last year. Have they met the deadline for this year? And I think that obviously if a project changed, the deadline or they would have to resubmit information on the project. But that's another question that probably should be wrestled with so there's clarity in the law. And then finally, with the pandemic slowdown this last year, I've heard from some cities that they've seen a decline in their sales tax revenues, even though the state has actually seen a fairly robust sales tax collection. And the sunset dates we put in all of these laws refer to the earlier of X years or X dollars collected. And if the pandemic has dramatically slowed collections, some of those cities may need an extension to make sure they can cover their debt service costs. So, Madam Chair, I know I went long, but I appreciate the opportunity to further discuss or answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I think we'll save the questions for the end. Next up, we have Ms. Nauman from Metro Cities. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to comment today. And my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing cities in the 7-county metropolitan area. And I first off want to just say I echo Mr. Carlson's appreciation expressed to Ms. Hagler for the wonderful presentation. It was chock full of information presented very concisely and some good reminders about some of the history too, and reasons and timing of some of the laws governing local option sales taxes. I also appreciated the opportunity to review the memo and certainly to provide some perspectives. I will also say the same is true for Metro Cities. The organization does not lobby on behalf of individual cities when they are seeking local option sales taxes, but we do have a general policy. And I wanna just speak to that with respect to the context and content of the memo. So the Metro City's policy on local option sales taxes is actually not that old, probably relative to how long I'm guessing that the League of Minnesota Cities has had a policy on the issue. I want to say it's probably been about 6 years since we had any policy at all on local option sales taxes. And that policy came about from cities, of course, in the metropolitan area in our membership that were starting to have these conversations about revenue diversification and wanting to see a little bit more content and detail in our legislative policies. As Mr. Carlson has pointed out, and I think this really is one reason we do have a policy now, is there is just more pressure on the property tax for local governments. And it also reflects, I think, some of the changing and evolving needs for cities in the metropolitan area, suburbs in the metropolitan area that are growing. Certainly core cities have had different ability to secure local sales taxes, but prior to just a few years ago, it was, I think, really, I've been around the tax committees for a long time, and it was really unheard of for suburban communities to come forth and request a local option sales tax. The issues that, we are continuing to monitor the effects, sort of the changes that were made in 2019. I will just speak generally to Metro City's policy, and it basically does support the ability of cities to impose a local option sales tax for public improvements and capital replacement costs without the need for special legislation. I do recognize, and certainly Ms. Hagler's presentation confirmed, that requiring that cities come to the legislature for special approval is certainly a longstanding tradition in Minnesota, and I recognize that. But part of the policy does support, again, the ability of cities to impose local option sales taxes. And I want to just also recognize that with the changes in the 2019 law, which we did not weigh in on specifically, but I have gotten some feedback from cities since the changes in those laws, and I just want to offer that for your consideration today. Cities do support, cities that I've spoken to, and certainly Metro Cities as an association, does support having transparency for voters and citizens in any imposition of local option sales taxes. So the changes that increase the transparency are fine. I think it's important to make sure that there's a high degree of transparency. The reversal in the law that requires a city to go to the legislature prior to adopting a local referendum rather than having the city adopt its referendum first is something that I've gotten some feedback on, that there is some concern about that. And maybe it's just, I would say maybe it's less, one word I think I'd put on it is maybe it strikes some local officials as awkward, that they want to be able to get their local approvals first before approaching the legislature for that broad formal authority to approve the tax. So that's just a little feedback on that. With respect to regional significance, and I know that this has been an ongoing discussion, and I think Mr. Carlson said it well, that there is, that even without the definition in law, it certainly has been part of the debate on any requests for local option sales taxes. And I would just offer this, and it's probably going to sound I don't want to say wishy-washy, but I think cities would appreciate some clarity in what constitutes regional significance. There is a lot of subjectivity, of course, provided, because even though there is a definition in the law, it isn't fully fleshed out in terms of what that means. And I know that legislators have to struggle with that. We do appreciate, I think the fact that there is some subjectivity probably is a good thing. I think what we'd say is just perhaps consider having some consistency in standards that are practical, that are logical, that make sense, that sort of look at regional benefit using some sort of historical practices. And I think that also means recognizing and really getting into the nuances of the local requests to recognize that what may constitute a regional, an improvement locally that has regional benefit may differ from city to city, even if it's the same type of project, and that really needs to be looked at closely. So any kind of clarity that could be provided there would be useful, and we certainly would appreciate the opportunity to work with you going forward to provide local official input as you further weigh those questions. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Naumann. Next up, we have Mr. Peterson from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Bradley Peterson. I'm with the firm of Flaherty and Hood, and we represent the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I do want to make sure that the committee understands that while the CGMC itself does not lobby on behalf of any particular sales taxes, sometimes cities will hire our firm to work on specific sales tax proposals, and we are working on a couple of them this year. So I want to make sure that that's clear and out there. So first off, Madam Chair, I do appreciate the opportunity here to take some time to have this discussion. I think it's important for the committee to weigh these things, and I think it's important for the cities that are looking to come forward to hear your discussion. And so I appreciate that. I think I would largely agree with just about everything that Mr. Carlson and Ms. Nauman said about regionality, and so I don't necessarily need to belabor those points other than to say that, you know, each situation should be weighed in its own merits and its own context. The one other thing that I would add to regionality, though, is that I think the analysis needs to extend to those situations where visitors from outside the jurisdiction are placing some burden on city infrastructure that is beyond the reasonable capacity of the city's taxpayers to pay for themselves. In other words, folks from outside the city may already be utilizing city infrastructure to such an extent that they should share the cost of its update and burden. So in some ways, that's almost a reverse of the spillover effect. It's what are the pressures being put on a city by the folks who are coming from the outside. A few thoughts on projects, and we haven't spent much time yet talking about that. You know, I think the legislature really will need to contend with its history and some of its past decisions. From my perspective, your thinking should start with whether the type of project has been considered a capital project in the past for purposes of both sales tax and also state bonding. If it has, then I think the legislature would be hard pressed to explain to local officials and the public why it wouldn't continue to be. And if there are things that have typically been considered capital projects in the past that for whatever reason the legislature now feels is inappropriate for a local option sales tax, then those things should be enumerated in statute rather than being an unwritten rule or preference of the committee that may change depending on the committee's makeup. So in conclusion here, while I don't know that I've been able to give you much in terms of specific ideas to guide your thinking, hopefully I've given you some things to think about. Each sales tax proposal should be evaluated on its own merits within its own context. This means the legislature may have to make what appear to be subjective calls, even close calls. And that is what you're called upon to do. To the extent that your guidelines or the statutes become so prescriptive that they lack flexibility, then you may want to, as Mr. Carlson said, look to an option where you're allowing some cities in some circumstances to bypass the legislative process and go right to the folks, the people. To the extent that your decision-making is informed by pragmatism, consistency with past practice and current law, logic, and passes the smell test of common sense, local governments will have a better understanding of what is expected of them and will be able to have confidence in the work of the legislature. With that, I'm finished.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. You all have given us stuff to think about. Once again, when the cities and counties present their projects or proposals in division coming up, but be helpful if they were ready to answer what property tax rates are like in their jurisdiction, their overall levy, and the average change in their levy over the last few years. But with that, members, my hope is for us to get done by 4:25, and we have Representative Mark Hort's bill. But I would like to entertain a few quick thoughts from folks or see if anybody has questions for any of the testifiers before we move on. And I see Representative Mark Hort, you have your hand up.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And more of a comment, first of all, I want to thank you for really bringing this subject more to light and focusing on it here in our in the property tax division. You know, I mean, I think your memo that you sent out dealing with the issues of regionalization and what's a regional project and capital project and, you know, the equity issues, I think are important. And just kind of one point that I think illustrates why it's important that we really look at this issue is that our total state and local sales tax rate now is 7.45%. And that's an increase of 0.25% from 7.2 just in the last 5 to 6 years. So just by, you know, piecemealing these approvals to all the cities and counties and so forth has literally raised our state and local sales tax levy 0.25% without kind of anyone really noticing. So I think there's a lot of great issues, a lot of great testimony brought up today, but this is an important issue and one that I do believe the legislature has to continue to keep a close look at. And, you know, I think some of the issues that were brought up today are important for us to look at. But again, Madam Chair, thank you for bringing this issue forward.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Do I see any other folks' hands up for either the testifiers or thoughts that you have on regional significance that we may not have covered? Or maybe everybody's just deep in thought. Or it's just that time of day where everybody's sleepy. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm definitely sleepy, but I just wanted to make a quick comment that I have a problem understanding some of the, I guess 2020 was my first year on the property tax committee. So it's kind of the first time that I'd really looked at some of the local option sales taxes. And just for me, I felt like there were a couple of the proposals that were really clearly like, you know, a regional asset, but I had some problems understanding the kind of the pitch for some of the investments that really are like, the idea is that this isn't for sort of the normal things that a city needs to invest in. And so to me, you know, some of those things are roads, recreation facilities like parks and other things that sort of serve mostly the city or county where they're located. And so I guess I just wanted to make that comment that, as we're hearing these proposals, that I'm really going to be looking for a strong case, especially for those kind of investments that sort of seem more to be like a matter of course for like the basic services that cities need to provide their residents. I'm just very hesitant, you know, as Representative Marquardt pointed out, like to be overutilizing our most regressive revenue raising tool, which is the sales tax. So that's just my kind of perspective on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. You've kind of drilled down right into the heart of the problem that we're going to have to address when we hear these bills come before us. Were there any other questions folks had? I know this is not going to be the end of our discussion around this. I still want us to kind of grapple with what that definition could be or should be when we're approaching these bills. Members? With that, always feel free to email me or share with me or other members of the committee your thoughts on it too as we move forward. So next up, we'll have Representative Marquardt presenting his bill, House File 496. Representative Marquardt, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 496 for possible inclusion, to be laid over for possible inclusion into the Property Tax Division report.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Marquardt moves his House File 496 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. We have the language before us. Chair Marquardt, would you like to proceed with describing your bill?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And, you know, continuing with the goal of trying to make our tax system, property tax system, more accountable and more transparent to property taxpayers. This is an effort to really enhance the truth in taxation process, which began actually back in 1990. And so there are three main goals and three main provisions. And the three main goals that House File 496 tries to accomplish is, number one, is to allow citizens to have genuine input into the budget and levy planning process on the front end of the process rather than the back end of the process. The second goal is to give residents more information regarding the proposed budget and levy. And then the third major goal is to provide a predictable, consistent day, one day, a Minnesota property taxpayers day, where they can go in and talk about the levy. It's what you would call the TNT meeting right now. So how does the bill do that? There's three main ways. First of all, it establishes a Citizens Property Tax Advisory Committee, where the city and the county would have to come up with, try to enlist 9 residents to be part of that committee. And they would get in on the front end when the city or the county starts to propose the budget in the spring or the summer of the year. By the way, this bill involves cities and county, cities 500 population or more, and all school districts and all counties. This Citizens Advisory Committee does not apply to school boards because they're already required to do this under the world's best workforce. As I mentioned, there are the three goals, which I'm very set on, but I'm very flexible on how we get there. And so I've met with all of the groups and have heard some great ideas. And for example, on the Citizen Advisory Board, one group I met with said, well, what about the existing planning commission that a city or a county might have? You know, that's a great idea. So I'm open, but that it sets up the Citizens Committee because we know the budget is always by December pretty much cut and dried, and there isn't much input. This would actually allow public input where, you know, the fire department and the street department, the police department would come forward and say, here's our what we're looking at, and have people that would provide recommendations on that. The second piece would add information on that notice of your proposed property taxes that go out between November 10th and November 24th. It would be information that cities and counties right now provide to the state auditor. It would be the very same format. And instead of providing that information to the state auditor in November or December, it would have to be before September. But you could look at the current revenue budget and the current expenditure budget and then compare it with the proposed one and then the increase. And that would be on a separate sheet of paper that would now come with your property tax statement. And the third major change in the bill would set the first Wednesday after the first Monday in December as Minnesota Property Taxpayer Day. And it's set up so that counties would meet at 6, cities at 7, school districts at 8. They would have to allow this meeting to be attended virtually or in person. And the reason I say that is I've got my proposed property tax statement right here that came out. And for my city and my school, that meeting date was December 14th at 6 p.m. Both the city and the school board, very same day, very same time. And so those are the three goals. I know there's a number of testifiers here, but here's what I want to say. I think everyone agrees that we need to make this system so more people get involved and they feel they have genuine input. And you do that by making the system simpler, providing more information, and making it easier for people to plan a day. And I could see the media saying, hey, this is the day, Minnesota Property Taxpayers Day, and it would put a focus, and if people wanted to attend, you'd be able to attend all those meetings. So again, I'm setting my goals, but as I've told the groups of the testifiers that are going to testify, I'm very flexible on how we get there, and I've heard a lot of great ideas, but we're going to have, I think, Madam Chair, you're going to want this bill to be put together for sure towards the first week in March. And so I'm willing to work with anybody and everyone prior to that time in getting this done, but we need to get it done. Over $10 billion of property tax are paid by taxpayers around the state. That's only next to the income tax. We need to do what we can to make it more accountable, more transparent to property taxpayers. So that's House File 496, Madam Chair, and I'll take questions and listen to testimony.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. I think because of the time, looking at the time right now, it's about quarter after. I'd like the three testifiers to go. If they could limit their comments to about 2 minutes each, that'd be great. And then we will have time for some member questions for Representative Marquardt and the testifiers. So first up, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. My name is Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I want to let others on the committee know that this is not a new issue for Representative Marquardt. I have talked with him about this since he was a mayor many years ago, and we had a good conversation yesterday on his drive down to St. Paul, and I appreciate his openness and willingness to understand if this would work and how we could improve the initial proposal. So thank you very much, Representative Marquardt. You know, the League doesn't have a policy supporting repeal of truth in taxation. I think our city officials have gotten to understand the issue. They think it's a good opportunity to educate taxpayers. Could it be improved? I think there are things that people have suggested to me that could be improvements. But let me just quickly share a couple of concerns that were raised, because I did ask our city officials, and I got about 50 responses from cities about some of the challenges they may face. And I should also say that Metro Cities and the Coalition suggested that these were similar issues to what they were hearing as well, Ms. Nauman and Mr. Peterson. So briefly on the Citizens Property Tax Advisory Committee concept, I know Representative Marquardt had an option already to use the Planning Commission, but many of the cities, especially the small ones, said we frequently have challenges just getting somebody to run for city council, much less getting nine people to serve on a property tax advisory commission. So, and then several of the city officials said, isn't that my role and my responsibility as an elected official to effectively do that? So that was one set of concerns on the property tax advisory committee concept. We'll continue to look for options that may involve more citizens, Representative Marquardt. On the additional information, you know, one of the themes that I heard were that many cities have developed specific information that is asked for by their taxpayers. And some of it is contained in what Representative Marquardt's bill suggests. Some of it is not. Some of the cities do other things that their taxpayers are very familiar with. So prescribing without any sort of, ability to deviate from that might be problematic, because cities would have to jettison historical information or other information that their citizens have come to understand and expect. And there were some questions raised about the cost of the project or the process. And one other comment on the information, the one-page sheet is an interesting concept, but many of the cities said, you know, numbers don't tell the whole story. A budget really needs the narrative for the context to allow people to really understand what those dollars are being used for. And then on the single day of the property taxpayer hearing, you know, many cities meet just once a week and maybe only once a month. And many of the smaller cities said that that they don't have Wednesday council meetings. And so this would be another night to ask their council members to participate. And an interesting one that I hadn't thought of, many smaller cities share staff, and they would be in the tough position of having to figure out how to staff the hearing in two separate cities that they might work for. So some of the efficiencies our cities have found could actually make it a little more difficult to actually conduct that hearing on that single night. And then the issue was also raised about technology for holding remote hearings. I know that many cities were able to employ additional online meeting technology, especially with the CRF funds they received. But some cities still don't have that technology, and that's something we would have to consider. And then one additional comment, one city, you know, I guess would I say emphasized that they have previously held joint meetings with their city or with their county and with their school district. Obviously, that would be difficult for a county to do that with every city within a county, but they found that to be a very successful, efficient way to educate taxpayers. So Madam Chair, with that, I told Representative Marquardt yesterday that with every comment I got, I also submitted a request for ideas from our cities about what could work better or what in their city works really, really well. And I plan on sharing those with Representative Marquardt, and perhaps we can use some of those good ideas that cities are using right now to make this bill work even more efficiently. So I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Property Tax Division. My name is Denise Dietrich with the Minnesota School Boards Association. I am here today speaking on behalf of all the 333 of our locally elected school boards, and I have also been asked to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Business Officials. So first, we want to acknowledge and thank Representative Marquardt for his commitment to working on local school issues and his open communication with the education organizations. As to this bill, he did bring it to us in an earlier discussion, which is always appreciated. As school board members and business managers, that we understand that the need for transparency, and especially when working with taxpayers' dollars. And school districts work diligently to share information in multiple ways with community members. And as you know, school districts across the state differ greatly. And school districts also differ from counties and cities. Our differences present some challenges in a bill such as House File 496 in the area of logistics, timelines, and access. If I will jump right to section four of the bill. The timelines in that section present some challenges. This section requires the schools to report what is listed in statute. The district can report on the current year, but the budget for the following year has not yet been developed. Counties and cities run off of a calendar fiscal year. So in December, their current year and subsequent year budgets are ready. School district budgets are July to June and are not ready for the next year in December. And then if you go to the section titled the Minnesota Property Taxpayers Day, we ask Representative Marquardt, is it the intent to hold joint virtual meetings? If so, there are some logistical and access challenges to consider for school districts. First, the cities may wholly be in one county, but this is not the case for school districts. For example, Monticello School District has Wright County and Sherburne County. There are school district finance directors could not be in both counties at the same day at the same time. And then we have the reverse that's true. Aiken County has parcels that fall in 10 different school districts. Currently, not all school districts' budget meetings are not held at the same time, allowing taxpayers to attend multiple meetings, and this may limit participation. Second, the requirement of start times of 1 hour increments might not allow citizens the opportunity to provide their comments and feedback. 20 minutes of a presentation at the beginning of a hearing may not be enough to adequately describe the levy and budget situation fully and adequately. There are some things that come up during certain years that may require more time to explain. Are the county taxes increasing significantly? Is there a large operating referendum or building bond issue coming on board for the school district? Third, requiring the broadcast of the meeting creates some challenges.
Ms. Dietrich, I'm sorry, I don't want to cut you off, but I want to wrap it up because I still want to hear from Mr. O'Rourke and let Representative Green ask his one question. Perfect. And then we have a hard stop at 4:30 because session starts.
Perfect. I will conclude. The broadcast of the meetings creates some challenges for our rural school districts without adequate access to broadband. And this is just very similar to what we just experienced with distance learning. And so in closure, we want to point out that school boards have purposely developed multiple avenues to create taxpayer transparency in our districts. And we will seek to be as transparent as possible with our stakeholders in the future. And so we want to continue to work with Representative Marquardt to achieve that transparency in his bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. Mr. O'Rourke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Cap O'Rourke on behalf of Minnesota Small Cities. I will be quick. Mr. Carlson highlighted a lot of the concerns of our members. We represent communities with populations under 5,000. You know, we share Representative Marquardt's concerns and goals of getting more public input. I think on behalf of small cities, our biggest concerns are the functionality. Having a 9-member board, which is twice as big as many of our councils, and sometimes we often struggle to get people to run for council, and getting them to become a member of this could also be difficult. The staff time it takes, while it may not seem like a lot, our communities are often operating with 1 or 1.5 staff, and they're already doing yeoman's work with all the other duties that they have to do, and having to set up something like this and staff yet another committee on more nights, that's the biggest feedback we got from our members is how much, what is going to be, you know, we are all for increasing the public into the process, but we think there should be more incentives rather than mandates as we move forward. But we will continue to work. I had a conversation with Chair Marquardt, and we will continue to work with him to find solutions and find opportunities to get more public into the budgeting process of our communities.
Thank you, Mr. O'Rourke. Members, it's our plan to also bring back more discussion on this bill since we're laying it over for next meeting for questions, but I wanted to give Representative Green ability to ask a quick question. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. The concerns that I had and the questions I asked were all brought up by your three testifiers. And so when it comes back, I am more than confident that Representative Marquardt will be able to answer those questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, I want to give Representative Chair Marquardt the last word here before we move on.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I'm willing to work with members and the groups involved and so forth. Let's put something together and we'll work on that and put something that property taxpayers will have more accountability and more transparency. So looking forward to working forward on the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
My motion on House File 496 to lay over for possible inclusion into the property tax division report.
Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 496 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Members, like I said, Representative Marquardt will be back next week or the week after to answer more questions if you have them. Next week we'll be meeting is on our regular day, Wednesday, February 17th. We're going to hear from the Office of the State Auditor on tax increment financing, and there will be a few bills added to the agenda as well. Members, we are adjourned.